You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Manchester is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston. I'm your host for today's episode. We're recording probably around 15 hours after Manchester United lost 4-3 against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge down in London. I was joined at that game by Samuel Luckhurst, who is also with me on this podcast. Samuel, how are you? Did you get much sleep?
Not enough, but it was never going to be enough. You just crack on, don't you? Slightly weary, but there's work to do. Can't complain.
But I think you got more than me. Did you see you got up at 9:30?
I did. But as Tony Soprano would say, let's skip the preamble. Let's get down to it. Come on.
Yeah, very true. And you do have a child, which does influence things. Samuel, an absolute crazy game. It was almost a basketball game at times. Chelsea went 2-0 up. United did brilliantly to get back into the game, 2-2 at half time. Then Garnacho scored in the second half, 3-2. We were writing up our pieces, thinking, what a comeback. This is fantastic. And then the claps in added time. How did they manage to lose that game?
Bad game management, repeating mistakes, lack of focus. I mean, as you say, the our pieces just changed drastically because they went from olaying in added time 3-2 up to losing the game in a really perverse way. It was actually impressive how they lost that game. Because their game management up until the penalty that Dalot conceded was pretty good. They were knocking the ball about quite well. Mount came on and was very good. There was a confidence about them. You could sense the belief that they were going to home in on the victory. And then one mistake causes not just a collapse, but chaos. The screenshot from the restart after Palmer equalised, where United have got this innovative formation of something like 2-3-4-1, it just looks like a bunch of school kids playing football at lunchtime. Just and I should also add primary school kids. Just no concept of positioning. Tactics, game management. Dalot was just clearly desperate to atone for the error he made, that he wanted to score a winning goal. He loses the ball. And as remarkable as the finale was, what was also remarkable was that Chelsea went close to scoring twice at 3-3. And you think of I can't remember how many seconds there were between the goals, but even in that time frame, Mason Mount's putting in a brilliant tackle, and there's a deflected looping shot that just goes past Onana's post, which I'd completely forgotten about until I rewatched it back this morning. And then you've got the unforgivable act of no United player going to Cole Palmer, who, quick thinking, you know, asks for the ball early, gets it, and he earned his luck because he's a brilliant player. And he was, as soon as he scored his penalty, he wanted to get the ball and try and win the game. And as good as Anthony was last night, I'm sure we'll pay him his dues because he deserves it. It is absolutely unforgivable that United let Cole Palmer, who was born in Withenshaw, boyhood United fan, and somehow he slips through the net. It's inexplicable that. And you sensed it would come back to bite them at some point along the line. And he scored 4 goals against them this season. He's joined that elite list of players who have scored a hat-trick against United. But the game management from United, just in that period from Dalot conceding the penalty, which when they were showing the replays, I thought the referee might have been sent to the monitor because it was such a big decision. It was so late in the game. And it was not so much to advise him to overturn his decision, but have a look at it and be absolutely sure. But Dallow's body language was a giveaway. He stayed prone on the ground. The way he reacted to the restart, he knew that he'd made an error, that there had been sufficient contact to throw Madueke off balance, and it was just desperate. So I'm sure there are some United fans talking about refereeing, but this, if you're talking about refereeing, you know, leading to United's result last night, you need your head examining, because that's going to be the furthest thing from Ten Hag and the coaching staff and the players' minds. They were their own worst enemies last night. Their penchant for drama this season is just it's exhausting more than anything. It's exhausting just watching it from press box. I'm sure it's exhausting for the supporters, especially those who are being saddled with just utterly disgraceful kickoff times in London. There's another that's been announced this week, Palace away, 8 p.m. on a Monday, a bank holiday Monday next month. Just no concern for paying supporters, matchgoers whatsoever. And they're being put through the ringer, and not in a good way, unfortunately, for them. It almost feels like this season, with the amount of added time winners United conceded, it feels like there's recompense for what they did to Bayern Munich 25 years ago. It's quite extraordinary. But if you keep repeating mistakes, if you keep conceding goals from fullbacks, if you keep conceding goals in quick succession, if you keep conceding goals in added time, what do you expect? And it's that finale last night it's more evidence to file with this quite rather heavy dossier now of why they should sack the manager, which is a great pity, because the performance by and large last night was very good.
That Dallow penalty, I've seen some suggestions that it was soft, but the problem is it is accidental. It does kind of slip, but it's his arm. It's raised, and that does kind of put him off balance, and that's why the penalty was given. And as you've said, it seemed like Dallow kind of lost his head when the ball was played for the restart. And it's just absolutely unforgivable to leave Cole Palmer, who's been Chelsea's best player all season. He's actually in contention for the Golden Boot now in the Premier League after his hat-trick. Yeah. But to leave him unmarked on the edge of the box in the last minute of the game, it's amateur stuff, it's schoolboy stuff. But I mean, we've talked about this lack of in-game management all season. It's happened time and time again. So many late goals, conceding twice in quick succession. Is it a mentality thing? Is it a structure thing? Is it a tactical thing? Surely the players on the pitch need to take responsibility. Ten Hag talked about it's not ideal having your leaders going off the pitch. Obviously, Casemiro and Varane were substituted, but you shouldn't need Varane and Casemiro on the pitch to see out a game like that and to have some nous about you.
It's all of the above that you just mentioned. And in terms of the players and coming off, that's also on the manager. It's also on the staff. What the hell is going on there? Why did Varane not come off immediately? You had Harry Maguire imploring the bench to take him off. And he almost cost them towards the end of the first half when Conor Gallagher hit the post and Varane was clearly not comfortable. And then Johnny Evans comes on. He goes off after 20 minutes. That's four flies that have dropped over the past week. I would be pretty staggered if 31-year-old Varane or 36-year-old Johnny Evans recover in time for Liverpool the day after tomorrow. And then that list of, it would be up to 55, I think, in terms of injuries or illnesses that have led to a player missing a game this season. And we were sat right behind the dugout, and you and I, between us, we know what we know about medical and sports science and what have you, would, compared to Gary O'Driscoll, it's not even a fraction. He is an expert, yet we both know that Varane's got to come off there and then. And for some reason, there's a delay to it. I mean, what was the benefit of getting through to half time when you knew that he was going to come off anyway? So there are times when you just look at United and you just think this is amateur hour. I mean, it was amateur hour after Palmer equalised and the restart and the ridiculous formation. As somebody said as well, and look, I understood why McTominay came on. They needed some energy in midfield. But you're almost trying to rebrand, having rebranded him. We look at McTominay now as an attack-minded, attacking midfielder, a goal-getter. He's still being brought on in games to you know, try and help United hold on in circumstances or offer some protection to the back four. but he's been reprogrammed as a goal getter. So he's charging forward when he's not got the ball. And that's what he did at Stamford Bridge last season. He came on, he gave away a penalty, but he was, I think he was playing up front even when he came on, because it was Casemiro who got that equaliser, but McTominay was in the same vicinity as well. So there's confusion there just with the role of a substitute who was dropped yesterday. And beyond that, as I said, it's the same failings. And look, they find remarkable ways to cause drama in games. I think they've been involved in 5-4-3 games now this season. There have been 28 goals scored in the 80th minute and beyond in their 90-minute matches. And I would imagine the split there is now quite even after Chelsea scored the two goals in added time yesterday. Three teams have beaten United with added time winners this season now. Arsenal, Fulham and Chelsea, of course. Brentford got an added time equaliser. Bayern Munich technically got an added time winner against them as well. And this has been going on for, what, seven months now?
But all the problems we've talked about on the podcast, it's all been the same problems, hasn't it? That's the thing. It's been like Groundhog Day. It's the same podcast every week when you watch United. Even when they win, they're not convincing.
In any industry, you have to be judged on what you're doing, not what you've done. And what they're doing at the moment is at times it's diabolical. I mean, the performance was a huge, huge improvement on the Brentford performance. The Brentford performance was their worst of the season, I thought. But even when they play well, there are caveats to it. And the big bloody caveat last night is that they lost 4-3, and they lost the most extraordinary circumstances you could possibly imagine, conceding a goal, an equaliser in the 110th minute and the winner in the 111th minute, having been knocking the ball around in added time with their supporters olleying every pass. Ten Hag has said previously this season they've got to do it for 90 minutes. I mean, that's an understatement now with the added time. But that mindset of the players, of the squad, of the team, it's not right. They are not at the level that they need to be. They've gone massively backwards on last season, when it felt like the mentality was much improved on the 2021-22 season. But this has been a stark regression, to the point where they've lost 12 Premier League games, which is as many as they lost under Moyes and Giggs in 2013-14, and as many as they lost under Solskjaer and Rangnick a couple of seasons ago. And let's face it, the question of can you still qualify for the Champions League is redundant now, because they're not going to qualify for the Champions League. And when Manchester United failed to qualify for the Champions League, there is either a change of manager during the season or at the end of the season. And I'd be amazed if this is the exception to that.
It's the same problem in midfield, Samuel, and you kind of mentioned the midfield there, but it was non-existent. Again, ironically, it was a game, I think, between two sides that didn't really have a midfield. It was such an end-to-end game. I think everyone was puffing their cheeks at half-time in the press box. You kind of just watched these teams going back and forth. Yeah. The counter-attacks were just constant. They just kept on happening in these breaks and just massive pockets of space. I feel really sorry for Kobbie Mainoo at the moment. He seems quite exposed in that midfield, and Casemiro's drop-off certainly hasn't helped that. Fernandez is a bit erratic sometimes in possession and struggles to retain it. And when you don't have a midfield, you concede an absolute bucket load of shots. And United have now conceded 225 shots in the league in 2024, which is more than any team in Europe's top five leagues. And when, as we've mentioned before in the last podcast, Samuel, when Ten Hag keeps on getting asked about that, he keeps on playing it down. I actually quoted that stat with, do you know the gif of the little dog sitting in the house and it's burning with
yes,
fire, and
it's this like, is fine.
This is fine. This is fine. Well, it's not fine. It's clearly not fine.
He called it ridiculous last night when it was put to him, but ridiculous because people are talking about it. He's not having it. His head is very, very firmly buried in the sand where the shot stat is concerned. And that's just a manager in denial, because the chances are, the more shots you attempt at goal, the more likely you are to score. The weekend game was a freak in that Brentford had 31 attempts at goal and somehow only scored once. They hit the woodwork four times. Onana made some good saves. They had some other good opportunities where it's gone off target or Tony had a disallowed goal.
They
had literally every single variety.
Way more than that. Yeah.
they had pretty much every single variety of chance or near miss that you could think of, apart from maybe a penalty miss or a penalty save. And if you just carry on regardless, and look, the midfield situation, he clearly doesn't feel as though that there is that there's an available solution there. I think most would agree Casemiro Mainoo is the most balanced option, but it's imperfect and it's short term. And Casemiro cannot be at United next season. He certainly can't be a starter at United next season. And would they entertain the prospect of having him in a squad player role on his salary, even with the Champions League 25%, sorry, the no Champions League 25% reduction? I struggle to believe it. I think if you're Ineos, if you're Sir Dave Brailsford or whoever's going to be overseeing recruitment, you've got to be looking for a buyer there, and you've got to be signing a player for that role as well. And that, as I said before, that will be their most important signing for the squad in the summer. It'll be the player who goes in there to accompany and complement Kobbie Mainoo. But Rio Ferdinand raised a very good point during his rather high profile podcast appearance yesterday with Gary Neville, when he said that these players are not protecting Mainoo. And a young player going into winning United dressing rooms or successful United dressing rooms, the young player was always protected, whether it was Roy Keane or Brian Robson kicking an opponent, or whether it was Sir Alex Ferguson not overplaying them or resting them here and there. I mean, it applies to Garnacho as well. He started 28 games on the spin. He's been their player of the season. He never goes into hiding. He always runs. His work rate is tremendous. He was excellent last night. And clearly Ten Hag, that must have come into the thinking. He wants to give him a breather ahead of another big game on Sunday that he will start in. But those two lads, that what United are asking of them, it's far too taxing. And the experienced players are not stepping up anywhere near often enough. And it's not for want of trying. I don't look at this team and think there's a lack of commitment there. It's not like the final days of Mourinho, where you had the odd poisonous player in the squad who just decided not to bother. It's not like the Rangnick era where some players mentally checked out. Yeah, I don't think they clearly haven't. Look at the way they played last night. They were bad on Saturday, but they were just bad because there were poor selections made, and they're gettable, and their back four is often exposed because the balance of midfield isn't right, and because Casemiro's having a really bad season. But this season is, I mean, even though they've got the FA Cup to play for, which is a treasurable trophy and one that hopefully if United say they'll get to the final of, as far as the league is concerned, it almost feels like a write-off. They've got Europa League purgatory to come next season. I've no faith in the teams below United to finish above them, to knock them down to seventh or eighth or ninth in the table. And I've absolutely no faith in United capitalising on any more points dropped by Tottenham or Villa. Tottenham have dropped points how often recently? They dropped points again in midweek. Villa lost again in midweek. What were the scores at the weekend? I forget. Tottenham and Villa won at the weekend
as well. Yeah,
and so a bit of added pressure, and United produced their worst performance of the season. Whatever the circumstances, it's moot now. It doesn't matter what time Tottenham kick off or what time Villa kick off. Manchester United will not be in the Champions League next season.
And on that bombshell, we'll leave it there for part one, and we'll be back in a moment for part two. Welcome back to part two of the Manchester is Red podcast. We're going to try to make some sense, some more sense of this performance and defeat on first night against Chelsea. And we'll talk a bit more about Ten Hag at the start of this section. I know you basically ended the first part of that, Samuel, but there was a moment where he went up to the away end before the game and he applauded the supporters and they responded with generous applause back. There's been a split between the fan base on whether they would want Ten Hag to stay. There's obviously been growing pressure, as I said. I think the pendulum is starting to swing now because these performances are just so unforgivable, indefensible, really. There is still a section of supporters that would like them to stay, but what are the reasons now to to continue with Ten Hag, because obviously it doesn't make sense to sack him right now, but if United get into the summer, then a change could be likely.
So the question is, what are the reasons to keep him?
Yeah,
His development of the young players. The first season was a very good season. Occasionally, they play some good football. The players are still playing for him. Beyond that, I'm struggling.
You turn it on the flip side, and you think of the reasons in the con section, and you think lack of structure, conceding a ton of shots,
no style.
Yeah.
Iffy recruitment, some bizarre to comments, say the least.
Press conferences, yeah, really well, poor recruitment. I think it's fair to say now, and with the benefit of hindsight, actually over 400 million spent, and that's not been good enough.
Is his Champions League record with United and Ajax going out of the group stage three times out of five campaigns? The regression this season, going out the second hurdle of the League Cup, going out of European competition altogether in a group that they were favourites to progress from, as impressive as Copenhagen were. United should have been finishing second in that group if they did anything about them. The injury toll as well. He has to take accountability for that. It's not solely on him, but the amount of injuries they've had this season, and they're not the only club that have had huge injury problems, but his intense training demands, I've written stories on it. Others have written stories on it. They've had a bearing on the amount of injuries United have had. And he defended that in midweek. He claimed that they don't train too hard. But I think that's just face-saving. And he's in an invidious position because his rhetoric has definitely changed since Jim Ratcliffe was the only bidder left at the table. He started making excuses, citing the injuries and not being able to play players regularly, but that's on him. And also in terms of the balance and the players you could choose, I mean, nobody even asks about Sofyan Amrabat as a defensive midfielder to come in and maybe offer a bit of security in front of that back four, because he's not good enough to play for Manchester United.
10 million as well, a loan fee. 10 million is a lot of money.
Yeah, and people, like, I didn't watch Amrabat a lot, but I'd have looked at those circumstances. Guy who was not particularly well known outside Morocco and Italy, and maybe a section of the Netherlands, has a very good World Cup, then wants to leave Fiorentina. Should you be signing that profile of player who also played for Ten Hag once upon a time at Utrecht? No. Get United yielded to Ten Hag's wishes on deadline day. And now he's just not in the reckoning. I mean, how many times he started in the last 4 months, or since he went to the AFCON? I think he must have had one start, Forest away in the FA Cup. Has he even played since he came on against City and turned attack into defence and gifted City a third goal? I don't think he has. You know, it's been a bad signing, yet there's clearly a vacancy there because Casemiro looks like he's on his last legs.
And if Amrabat had anything about him, he'd be starting games, wouldn't he? Because Casemiro has just been so poor, unfortunately.
Yes, but he's not good enough for Manchester United. And as I said, just because a guy tackled Mbappe and has got a big following online doesn't mean you should sign him. But there are times when United still make decisions that it gives the illusion that Ed Woodward is on the board or Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's in the dugout. I can fathom it. You can see why Ten Hag wanted him. But I just, there are times when United's interest in players is established and it comes out and you hope it's not accurate. You hope for their sake it's not correct. And then, of course, it turns out to be. Or you source it originally yourself or you write it yourself. And that was an example of it, Amrabat. I kind of despaired at that. And look, you and I don't know as much about football as Ten Hag, but I'd argue that we know more about Man United than Ten Hag, and sometimes that has to be factored into such a decision-making process. And that's just one issue. It's a pretty minor topic in the grand scheme of things. but it's still quite a big red flag. And as I said earlier, Manchester United, since Ferguson, if they don't qualify for the Champions League, there is a managerial change. It's either already happened or it's going to happen. And it's a real shame, because I think another reason to potentially keep him is the authority restored to the manager's role. The way he's dealt with Ronaldo, De Gea, Sancho and Rashford, I couldn't fault any of that. He did absolutely the right thing.
It's brilliant
to
have a manager who can have that personality. He clearly does have the right personality to manage the club and be an enforcer, which they need. However, at the end of the day, what happens on the pitch ultimately decides the narrative. And there's no structure, no style of play, and the performances are just that's what decides it at the end of the day, doesn't it?
Of course it does. But if he goes, there are players who should be ahead of him in the queue to go before him. Because
the last few managers, and there's players that just outstay them. You look at Martial.
Yes, there are. Martial will be going this summer, thankfully, for United. But there are other players who are not so much deadwood, but it's almost deja vu. A manager comes in after Marcus Rashford has had a substandard season, and he could be asked, like, can you get the best out of Marcus Rashford? Yes, I can. Why should it always be down to a manager? Why is the player not taking more accountability? And look, clearly Rashford is, you know, there's a sensitivity there. The fact that his brother felt the need to address a couple of United greats' opinions, well-founded opinions as well, and opinions that I think a lot of supporters would agree with on Rashford's difficulties this season. But why he feels the need to address that is beyond me.
Is that not really last year Gary Neville did a podcast with Rashford, and they seemed quite close, and it seemed quite friendly, and it was a decent watch actually. And then 12 months later, because that was just in the summer, was it not, in Portugal when doing that interview? And now this is happening.
But that's quite, you know, it's quite commonplace in the industry. I've had it to a far lesser extent, that if you deal with an agent over certain things regarding their client, their player, they'll think you're in their pocket, and they won't expect you to be critical of them when you should be critical of them. And so it's a jolt when you are critical about this player, when you might have done not done a favour, but that they may feel as though you're on side. I did it with the agent of a United player last season who said, just we thought you were on our side, because I'd written that the club were planning to sell the player. And then in the summer, it transpired that the club were planning to sell the player. It was very, very public knowledge. But this is how it works. And look, they underestimated Gary Neville. If you think Gary Neville is... Look, I know Gary Neville, there have been times with him in the past, I suppose Joe Hart, when he was England goalkeeper and Neville was an England coach, and there was a feeling that Neville was giving him an easy ride when he was a pundit, even though Hart's form for City was problematic in 2012, 2013. So there have been times like that where Neville's been accused of favouritism or bias, but he's not a coach anymore, and he doesn't have those attachments as much. And I suppose it comes out every now and then, and of course I think he's probably been accused of it with Maguire, because he had a one-on-one with Maguire a few years ago, and he's not been as critical of him as others have been, and he's been more defensive of him as well.
It wasn't really criticism though, Samuel, was it? Didn't he say he doesn't look right? Like, that's nothing in the grand scheme of things, surely.
No, but of course when you've got Gary Neville, Rio Ferdinand, former Manchester United captain, two of the greatest defenders to play for the club, who've won the European Cup, won multiple Premier League titles with them, their voices carry weight. Those quotes are going to get written up, and they're going to, on a quiet midweek match day, on a quiet Thursday, they're going to dominate the football news agenda up until kickoff. So what do you expect? Rashford's, you know, he is a topic of discussion. And then before that, he was dropped last night. And I thought Ten Hag's quotes, I have an issue with that, because they are clearly treading on eggshells with Rashford. There are sensitivity issues there. They don't want to upset him. Roy Keane said on that podcast yesterday, he needs a kick up the arse. And there's a reason why Roy Keane hasn't been in management for a very long time. And when Ten Hag summoned Rashford to put him on, he was patting him on the back. There was, if you were a body language expert or looking to scrutinise something or looking to find something untoward, there was nothing untoward during their exchanges there when the player was getting ready to come on. But he's, you know, this is 2 months running now. The player has had a pop at the media in his 2,000 odd word essay last month, verbal essay. And then his brother has come out and had a pop at pundits. Certainly Neville, possibly Ferdinand as well, because Ferdinand, you know, raised the issue of possibly the company Rashford keeps, which I think is absolutely relevant as well. Not saying about immediate family members, but there are one or two people around him that I think he should have distanced himself from a while ago. And there's someone that he's, you know, kind of in cahoots with, has got into cahoots more recently, that was extremely ill-advised as well. Kiffin, who they also represent, and their past dealings with United.
I was going to say we'll delve into individual performances. We basically have. It's been a nice little segue anyways. Anthony, let's give him his flowers. Did not expect that performance. It kind of felt like, dare I say, the night that Anthony arrived, almost. It's almost like there was an imposter playing in his shirt, because from the first whistle, I thought he was really sharp. He looked like the most likely to create something. He was cutting inside on that right, bombing down the wing, and he actually looked fast, Samuel. I don't know where he got his speed from all of a sudden.
He did.
Maybe he had a Lucas Aid or a Red Bull before the game and gave him wings down that wing. The only blemish on his performance, obviously, was conceding the penalty in the first half. I think it was a bit naive to make a challenge from that angle. He was never going to win the ball on Cucurella. But that aside, I thought he was really, really good. He obviously had a kind of a role in all three goals, because he did brilliantly keep the ball in for the first. He obviously picked the right pass for the second to find Dalot on the left wing, and then the assist with the outside of his foot. He still used his right foot, didn't he? Sorry, his left foot. He still used his left foot playing that pass through to Garnacho, who finished nicely. It was just a shame that, by the final whistle, it was kind of made redundant, his performance.
I think that's maybe a bit unfair on him in terms of redundant, because he could be a turning point for him.
Not him individually, overall pitcher, obviously. On an individual basis, fantastic for him.
And it wasn't. He could have been the story last night, or one of the main stories last night, and he wasn't. I mean, when the teams dropped and you saw Anthony was starting, of course, Cole Palmer was always going to start. You thought, well, there's an easy and obvious angle to do a piece on the two left-footed, right-sided wingers, one who was born in Withenshaw, boyhood United fan on their doorstep, another one they overspent on investing 100 million euros in. And it turned out both of them played very well. And Palmer had the last word, of course, getting the hat-trick, getting the winning goal. But it was Anthony's best performance for United. And I thought he played very well against Chelsea earlier in the season. So maybe if you're a real sceptic, you'd say, well, that's the caveat. I mean, Chelsea are still, in spite of last night's win, they are a dysfunctional side.
Cucurella, you know, Samuel. I saw a clip on Twitter this morning of Anthony beating Cucurella playing for Brazil versus Spain. So maybe he's just got a liking in play against Cucurella at fullback.
Quite possibly. I mean, Cucurella's no slouch, but he looked slow last night, and Anthony did look quick. Spoke to a season ticket holder this morning, United season ticket holder, and they said that the difference is when a defender caught up to him, he didn't stop and go back. He just knocked it forward and, you know, backed himself to win the foot race, and he did. He did against Cucurella. Cucurella is only the second other. There have only been two fullbacks that Anthony has properly ridiculed for United. The first and only one before last night was Dan Burn, who you look at him and you think, well, if you're a winger and if you're quick, he should be quite easy to play against. Okay, he's quite gangly and physical and he can get his body in the way, but there's no pace there. There's no real fleet of foot. Cucurella is a very different profile of left back. And as you said, I thought he started very well. He was been told to get back by Ten Hag. He did get back and very naively conceded the penalty. Very much it's just a classic forwards challenge in the penalty area. No complaints about that. But he had the resilience to, as you say, salvage that attack, where he did well to keep the ball in. Dreadful error by Caicedo, but, you know, fair play to Ante. He did have a hand in all three goals. Wonderful assist for Garnacho to make it 3-2. Terrific raking pass for Garnacho. United's second goal was a brilliant, one of the best team goals I've seen all season, for starting from Onana and ending with Fernandes. It was so well worked. Just a lovely, lovely goal.
Everyone had a look simple, didn't he, actually? Fernandes to the back post.
He did, yeah. Terrific cross, terrific switch of play from Anthony. The awareness of Garnacho to use Dalot switching onto his right foot, the timing of Fernandes' run. It was such a laudable goal. And if they'd won, we'd have been dissecting it this morning, probably in a piece, but them's the breaks. They've ended up losing the game. And as far as Sunday is concerned, going back to Ten Hag's rationale for not starting Rashford, claiming that it was rotational, I think only Dwayne Maynard would believe that. He played 15 minutes for England against Brazil 2 weeks ago. He didn't come on at all in the Belgium game. He played 80 minutes against Brentford. Then he came on last night. You look at that team that Ten Hag selected last night. Other than Anthony, it was as predicted. It pretty much consisted of United's strongest players available to Ten Hag. You didn't look at that team and think, oh, he's only starting because it's rotational. Rashford was dropped last night and Anthony took his chance. And nobody of United persuasion or who goes to Old Trafford on Sunday, I would imagine, would be expecting or hoping Rashford to start against Liverpool. Because Anthony's played well. Garnacho's been back among the goals, having moved back to the left, which is Rashford's best position. You're only maybe looking at Hoyland, because Hoyland has been anemic since he returned from injury. Yet would you advise starting Rashford as a striker? And especially when Hoyland came off quite early last night. There's no logical argument to recall Rashford on Sunday. Fair dues to Anthony. He performed very well last night, and it would be perverse to drop him after that performance.
Yeah, he definitely took his chance. I thought Diogo Dalot really struggled, Samuel. Obviously, he started at left back. Wan-Bissaka was at right back in his natural position. We noticed that in the warm-up, that Wan-Bissaka was warming up down that side and playing crosses in, and that was obviously a talking point before the game. But we've mentioned Dalot's kind of mistake for the penalty and then not failing to close down Cole Palmer. I'd actually probably move Wan-Bissaka back to left back for the Liverpool game, because he performed well against Liverpool before the international break, and Dalot had such a regression at Stamford Bridge that it probably makes sense to play him on the right now.
There's an argument for it, certainly. I thought certainly in the first half Dalot struggled. He salvaged it with the assist. He was a lot steadier in the second half. A lot of fullbacks have struggled against Cole Palmer this season, but I think certainly switching them, it did make sense. I don't think you could continue with Wan-Bissaka at left back after the Brentford performance. Certainly in the next immediate game, that there is a case for it on Sunday, given Dalot's performance, given that he'll be up against, the left back would be up against Mohamed Salah as well. But yeah, it was one of those tactical choices, which is well-intended, which is logical. And then United concedes two goals by Chelsea exploiting them down each flank. Wan-Bissaka easily gets lured out of position at times.
Do you think both of their positioning was running behind? Questionable at times. And there was a lot of space between... The back line was quite disjointed. And when Chelsea were kind of breaking forward... And just beyond the centre circle, you would look at the defensive line, you think there's problems there, and kind of the distance between the defenders, I think, didn't look right at times. Wan-Bissaka was obviously advancing a lot, and I just thought their positioning was quite questionable, both Dalot and Wan-Bissaka.
It was, and...
That's again, another structural problem.
It's a structural problem, and I think I counted it earlier, I need to do a recount to double check, but I think last night was the 25th different back four they've played this season. I mean, amazingly, for four defenders who are quite senior, I'm pretty sure those four had not started a game together this season. And that accounts for the minus goal difference. It accounts for the amount of goals they've conceded. It accounts for them being out of the Champions League as early as they were. It accounts for them being thrashed 3-0 in the League Cup by by Newcastle back in October or November, whenever it was. I'd be 25, and it'll probably be a 26th different back four on Sunday, because it will almost certainly be Dalot, Kambwala, Maguire, and Wan-Bissaka. And look, there's a lucklessness to an extent regarding injuries, but that there are also big problems at United in terms of what the hell are they doing that's resulting in so many injuries this season. It always feels like there's some kind of crisis, or there's a fire that started that they're struggling to put out at the moment.
We'll leave it there for part two then, and we'll be back in a moment for part three. Welcome back to part three of the Manchester is Red podcast. I'm Samuel. On Sunday afternoon, it doesn't get much easier. United welcome Liverpool to Old Trafford, who of course they beat 3 weeks ago in the FA Cup 4-3. What a fantastic performance that was. That'll be remembered for decades, that result. I won't say a fantastic performance, Lucy. The extra time performance was pretty special. They were poor until the final moments of the normal time, weren't they? But Liverpool are going to be hungry for revenge, yeah. They're obviously fighting for the title in Jurgen Klopp's last season in charge. Got the added motivation of losing that match in the FA Cup. United are coming into the game like a wounded animal on the back of a few poor performances. Any changes? What are you expecting? What are your thoughts?
In fairness to United, they were good in the first 30 minutes against Liverpool in the Cup game. They should have gone 2-0 up in it. Certainly the last 10 or 15 minutes of the first half, that was when things went south. They conceded twice. And as you said, until Antony, came up with that unlikeliest of equalisers, United were meandering to a quarter-final elimination. I think, given what's to play for Liverpool, who are top at the time that we're speaking, and the chances are that they would probably need to beat United to go top again on Sunday, with so much riding on that game for them, and with this game coming so quickly after the extraordinary FA Cup tie, I think it's quite fanciful that Liverpool could come a cropper again against a United side that has lost so many games this season. That said, as Ten Hag has said a number of times, he's quite pleased with United's performances against the top four this season, in that he felt they were competitive against Arsenal, and they were very close to going 2-1 up in that game, but for the offside on Alejandro Garnacho, then it's an added time winner conceded. The Villa performances, I mean, the first half on the Old Trafford one was a weird one, because Villa just played into United's hands, and United did very well to come back, but at Villa Park, United got battered in that game after about 20-25 minutes, and were very fortunate to get a win. Anfield was a creditable draw. The cup game 3 weeks ago was just a bit of a seesaw game. United were brilliant after they made it 2-2. They were the better team for the rest of the 90-minute section. They were the better team in extra time. So it's Jekyll and Hyde stuff, I think, with United. I mean, we all knew that game last night at Stamford Bridge was going to be eventful. It was never, ever going to be quiet. It was never going to be a 0-0. There was always going to be some drama in it. And look, I think in terms of this weekend's game, the only way that there wouldn't be drama is if Liverpool are ruthless and they do to United what they have done to them a few times in recent years. They've beaten them 5-0, 4-0 and 7-0 in the last 2 years. And if they play at that level, then it will be an easy day for us to an extent, in that it will be an easy write-up and there won't be a great deal of drama. But it would possibly be the final nail in the coffin as far as the remote chances of Champions League qualification are concerned, and possibly as far as the manager is concerned as well, even though they've then got an FA Cup semi-final to play. Is it the week after next against Brighton? Yeah. I think it is, isn't it? It's Bournemouth away next week. So it's The mood among the, speaking to some of the supporters this morning, and some who were in the away end at Stamford Bridge last night, it's very, they feel very demoralised after seeing that defeat and after a long journey down, as I said, for very inconvenient kickoff time, and now they're getting saddled with 8 p.m. Bank Holiday Monday kickoff at Crystal Palace. So the mood, having been at a season high less than a few weeks ago, and fans rightly basking in the glow of that wonderful win against Liverpool, and you know, so much for them to celebrate and so much to write about, so much positivity to write about from that game. The mood, it's been a real come down with the performance against Brentford and then the defeat to Chelsea last night.
We've talked about Mason Mount quite a bit in the last few weeks. He obviously came, his cameo went under the radar against Liverpool in the FA Cup. Scored a goal against Brentford, and he obviously came on against Chelsea, this former club. He got quite the reception. I'd actually start him in this game, Samuel. We've kind of discussed the merit of that, and where is obviously the contentious point again. I'd actually drop Casemiro, a bit controversial. I put that on my panel. I think the midfield's much better balanced with Casemiro in the team, but at the moment I'm just not seeing much to justify him starting. He's not giving me much reason to give him the nod, other than the fact that he sits in front of that back four. But even then, he's not offering much protection. It would be a risk to start Mount, Maino and Fernandes. But I think I might go that way, actually, on Sunday afternoon.
I could see it, but I just think there's no method to that. I think you're it's not you. I could see Ten Hag doing it. I could see him recalling McTominay, going with McTominay, Maino. But I think that would be tantamount to a manager just crossing his fingers and hoping for the best, and hoping that they do what they did 3 weeks ago. And he kind of did that against Brentford, and look where it got them. The Liverpool game was salvaged nearly 3 weeks ago through a substitute scoring, and it was won by a substitute. So it made no sense to go with an unchanged team against Brentford.
Do you not believe we need to see Mason Mount to start, or is it just, am I just kind of shoehorning him in a team for the sake of it? I think he's been quite bright, actually, the last few weeks.
He has, and as I said, I'd have started him at Stamford Bridge, and when he came on, I thought he was good. He was very confident on the ball, utterly unfazed by the reception he got. As you said afterwards, he's got an underrated edge about him as well, which I like. He seemed to have actually thwarted a winning goal for Chelsea as well. He did brilliantly to get back and put that block in. Unfortunately for him, seconds later, nobody bothered to pick up Cole Palmer. But I think you would be, I do think you would be shoehorning him into the team this weekend, unless there's some tactical innovation that Ten Hag wants to go with. I mean, I've just thought of it now, but if there's no faith in Hoyland to start up front, which I think would be unusual.
We're talking about Maino and Casemiro and Fernandes there, but in the first section, we've just talked about the midfield being non-existent. So does it really make that much of a difference if I'm putting Mason Mount in? It's kind of doing the same thing again as insanity, I suppose. I know Casemiro's only kind of
returned. But they don't have a solution there. They don't have a solution.
That's the problem.
Nobody's going to be saying, yeah, put Amrabat in this weekend. Even though there would be some logic to it, because he's a defensive midfielder and he's younger than Casemiro, maybe he would offer more security. But I don't think he starts in the Premier League since the Anfield game in December, so that's pushing 4 months. If he'd had some game time recently, then I think we're actually doing him a favour in terms of giving him as much airtime on this podcast, because he's been an irrelevance for a good while, unfortunately for him. And if he had had some exposure, if he was getting used here and there, then I think there would be a case to say, well, it's he's got to be an option to bring in. But I don't think anybody's expecting him to come in and start this game. As I said, he started once since the Anfield game on December 17th, and that was away to Forest in the FA Cup when he played at left back, I think he did. And they tried that experiment of him moving into midfield. And
he's only actually started.
There were times when he was shaking his head at how poor he was. He would hit a dreadful pass, and he'd shake his head, or he was doing a face palm. That's how much he struggled. And okay, that night he was playing out of position, and He's played out of position a few times this season. But I think if you go Mount, Maynou, Fernandes, Nacho, Anthony, Hoyland, it's you're asking the question, where's the discipline? In a team that is very much lacking discipline when it comes to game management against the team that are currently top of the league.
I completely agree, but you take my point. Well, where's the midfield at the moment, even with Casemiro playing? It's hard to defend at the moment. The problem is
there is not a solution. And the manager is at the point now where it's almost past the point of you can't trial solutions at this stage of the season. We're in a run-in, and United have got, really, they've got to be trying to win every Premier League game they play, and they've already failed on that count because they've dropped 5 points in the two games since the season resumed, and they've got an FA Cup semi-final to prepare for as well. So whatever team Ten Hag picks on Sunday, there'll be holes in it, so to speak, because they're not watertight. They concede far too many goals. They concede a ridiculous number of shots. And the chances are it will be the 26th different back four they've fielded this season. So if they come through it, if they get a win, fair dues to them, they'll have really earned it.
7 games left after this Liverpool game. You suggested that it could be the nail in the coffin for the Champions League hopes. They're currently 9 points behind Tottenham in 5th and 11 behind Aston Villa in 4th. It really could be curtains, couldn't it, if they lose to Liverpool on Sunday?
Yeah, I think I've said that already. Just mathematically, no, but I mean, it already is. They won't qualify for the Champions League season. They won't finish 5th. This coefficient's nonsense either. They won't finish 5th. Unfortunately, I think they're just marooned in 6th, as they were 2 seasons ago when West Ham had their best season in decades, United their worst season in decades, and United still finished above West Ham.
It adds to the embarrassment as well, Samuel, if 5th gets Champions League, which is looking likely now with the coefficients, and United still don't qualify for Europe's premium competition. That is really
embarrassing. Of course it does. I think a lot of people would have had United down at the start of the season in their predictions to finish in the top 4, because Tottenham had hired a new coach. Chelsea, look at them this season. Look at them this season as well. Villa were good last season under Emery, but did anybody think they'd climb as high as 4th in April? Probably not. United invested quite heavily in summer. They signed more players in the summer transfer window than they ever have done before. I'd have said that they were, the odds for them finishing in the top 4 would have been very, very short, having finished 3rd last season as well. But they're not going to do that, and that's a big black mark against the manager.
Thanks for your time, Samuel. We'll leave it there.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks to listeners as usual. I hope that episode was relatively therapeutic after that performance. We'll be back on Monday after the Liverpool game to reflect on that game. Have a good weekend and take care.